Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
With DoorDash, you can now get even more delivered to your door. Groceries, self-care, restaurants, and snacks. With $0 delivery fees on your first order. Get more from your neighborhood delivered with DoorDash. Terms apply. Visit DoorDash.com.
The most epic story of all is the one you can imagine with Audible. Surround yourself with out-of-the-world adventure. Land yourself a killer case that's yours to solve. And let yourself experience the drive that builds a champion. Epic stories told by your favorite Canadian voices, like Joshua Jackson, Kobe Smulders, and Sidney Crosby. With so many audiobooks, podcasts, and originals, there's more to imagine at audible.ca.
You're listening to the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Oliver Conway. This edition is published in the early hours of Friday, the 12th of May. The US is preparing for a surge of arrivals at its southern border as pandemic-era restrictions expire. South Africa is accused of secretly supplying weapons to Russia. And
We've got about a maximum estimate of just under 15 metres.
Right.
Which huge. Is huge.
That is a huge, great
yeah,
big thing.
That would have a skull 4 to 5 metres long.
The discovery of the fossilised remains of a massive 150 million-year-old sea creature. Also in the podcast, Pakistan's Supreme Court rules that the arrest of the former Prime Minister Imran Khan was illegal, and the mysterious untitled book with a secret author topping the charts. What to do about the thousands of migrants hoping to cross into the US from Mexico? It's an issue that has troubled American politicians for years. The crisis has become particularly acute in recent days ahead of the expiry of COVID-era restrictions known as Title 42. For 3 years, this has in effect shut the 3,000-kilometre-long US border with Mexico. But the measure runs out on Thursday night, and that has prompted another surge of people gathering at the frontier in the hope of getting across. Our correspondent Sophie Long has been speaking to people near the border in El Paso, Texas.
They just don't know what is going to happen. All they do know is that people will continue to come. Now, this isn't the first time that they have experienced a surge in number of people coming across the border into El Paso. It's happened in December of last year, in January as well, when President Biden came here to visit and see it for himself. So people are used to dealing with a huge influx of numbers. I spoke a little earlier to Susan Goodell, who runs one of the food banks here in El Paso, and she told me a bit more about what people here in El Paso have been experiencing.
Migrants come into El Paso really with practically nothing. There were over 1,200 living on the street just a couple days ago, and I could not be more proud of this community and their willingness to help. None of the migrants are able to cook foods. They have no kitchens, and they're reliant on the food bank to prepare foods for them or to have ready-to-eat foods.
Susan Goodell, and the Republicans are obviously critical of President Biden. What can be done to address the numbers wanting to cross into the US?
Yeah, there is huge criticism of the new measures that have been unveiled to deal with migrants coming in once Title 42 is lifted. People like Greg Abbott, for example, the Republican governor of the state of Texas, has said that lifting Title 42 restrictions is like putting out a welcome mat for illegal immigrants. On the other side, though, you have human rights organizations, immigrant rights organizations, saying that the new policy will be even harsher than those that were set out under President Trump. Now, I've been to several of the camps on the Mexico side of the border where people have been living for many months, some of them even years, and they are desperate, as you can imagine, to make their way back across the border. Now, one of the things with Title 42, it gave the authorities the right to expel them pretty immediately, but it didn't stop them from coming back. And some migrants that I've spoken to on the streets of El Paso have come across several times. This, in some cases, was their seventh attempt of making it into the United States. Now, under the new scheme, which is known now as Title 8, it's a decades-old code which covers immigration in the United States. There is some criticism of that from immigrant rights organisation, because what it means is that if they are found to have come here illegally and cannot prove the right to seek asylum here, then they will be expelled and they will be banned from trying to come back into the United States for 5 years. So that's one of the elements of the new policy that has attracted some criticism. What President Biden's administration will say to that is that the immigration system is broken, it is outdated, it needs reforming. There's only so much one man can do, even if that man is President of the United States of America, and that Congress needs to act.
Our correspondent Sophie Long in El Paso in Texas. Russia's invasion of Ukraine prompted many nations to pick sides, but some claim to be neutral. One of those was South Africa. However, it has now been accused by the US of supplying weapons and ammunition to Russia. South Africa said it was disappointed by the accusation made by the American ambassador there. I heard more from our correspondent in Johannesburg, Pumza Fihlani.
Well, the ambassador has made some very damning accusations against South Africa. He claims that a ship that had docked in South Africa for a period of about 2 days in December off the coast of Cape Town was allowed to load ammunition and weapons. It's believed that these same weapons were used in the ongoing conflict between Ukraine and Russia.
This occurred when those controversial military exercises were taking place, did it?
It preceded those military exercises, which happened months later. But even back in December, questions were being asked about whether even allowing Russia to move in South Africa very much as business as usual was not creating the impression that South Africa was, in fact, quietly backing Russia. What these allegations now have done is they've created a flashpoint where South Africa, it will be difficult for them to say, should it be proven that this is true, to continue insisting that they are neutral. At best, they will be regarded as a soft ally to Russia. Some people, though, have even gone far as saying that if these allegations are proven, some people could say that this is even evidence that South Africa is complicit in that war that Russia is waging against Ukraine. It creates a very uncomfortable situation for South Africa.
What could this mean going ahead, though, for South African relations with the United States?
In fact, it's that same relationship that now seems to be responsible or at the heart of why South Africa has struggled to distance itself from Russia and to flat out condemn the invasion in the way that other countries in the West, for example, have been able to do. But it's important to state that even the ANC itself, people within the party are divided on whether this is the right stance. Some people still believe they owe a huge debt to Russia for the support that they landed for freedom under apartheid. But now some believe that that relationship is out of kilter with South Africa's foreign policy, which is more aligned with Western countries in terms of democracy and the role that it sees itself playing in the world than it is realistically to Russia. It even has a much larger trade relationship with the US and a negligible relationship in terms of trade with Russia.
Pumza Fihlani in Johannesburg. Meanwhile, the UK has become the first nation to supply Ukraine with the long-range missiles it's been demanding. The Storm Shadow cruise missile has a range of over 250 kilometres, compared to the 80 kilometres of the US-supplied HIMARS. The British Defence Secretary Ben Wallace made the announcement shortly after Ukraine's President Zelensky told the BBC he needed more military equipment before Ukraine could begin a long-expected counter-offensive. Here's our diplomatic correspondent, James Landell.
President Zelensky has a huge decision before him. When should he launch a counter-offensive against Russian forces occupying his country? At stake are not just the lives of his own troops, but also the continuing support of Western allies and potentially even the outcome of the war. He told the BBC he had enough people, they were motivated and ready, but he needed time for more weapons to arrive. One of his key demands is for longer-range missiles, and the Defence Secretary, Ben Wallace, told MPs the UK was in the process of delivering exactly that.
The donation of these weapon systems gives Ukraine the best chance to defend themselves against Russia's continued brutality, especially the deliberate targeting of Ukrainian civilian infrastructure. Ukraine has a right to be able to defend itself against this. The use of Storm Shadow will allow Ukraine to push back Russian forces based within Ukrainian sovereign territory.
Most of Ukraine's existing missiles have a range of about 50 miles, but the Storm Shadow can reach up to 150 miles away from the aircraft that launches it. Crucially, This would give Ukraine the ability to target Russian command centres and fuel and ammunition dumps deep behind its lines, a key capacity in any counteroffensive, curbing Russia's ability to manoeuvre and fight back. But amid all this, there are growing fears in the West that too much pressure is being put on Kyiv to launch its offensive. Sir Alex Younger, the former head of MI6, told the BBC Ukraine should not be rushed.
We need to back off. We get one shot at this, we are going to achieve nothing by forcing Ukraine into moving prematurely.
So for now, the flow of weapons into Ukraine continues. But will the United States follow Britain's lead? Thus far, it's been reluctant to give long-range missiles, fearing escalation.
James Landale, our diplomatic correspondent. After two decades in power, the Turkish president Recep Tayyip Erdogan is facing one of his toughest political challenges in the elections on Sunday. The vote is expected to be tight, with the main opposition bloc's candidate, Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu, ahead in the opinion polls. One of the four opposition candidates has pulled out of the race, which could increase the chances of a defeat for Mr. Erdogan. The outcome is likely to be decided by the almost 5 million first-time voters, as well as women who make up more than half the electorate, as Selin Girit reports.
Just a few days before one of the most crucial elections in Turkish history, presidential candidates are holding their last rallies.
President Erdogan has been in power since 2003, and now, after two decades, he faces the stiffest challenge from the main opposition bloc's soft-spoken candidate Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu, whom many describe as Mr. Erdogan's antithesis. Key to winning are nearly 5 million first-time voters, almost 8% of the electorate. Most of them were born after Mr. Erdogan came to power.
I think Recep Tayyip Erdogan is a charismatic leader.
I meet 20-year-old Salih, a university student. He says he's going to vote for Mr. Erdogan and his party.
There were some problems of Turkey before, which are energy, and Turkey was dependent to the other countries in military. Turkey is creating and producing its own national products. Erdogan solved this problem.
In his early years in power, Mr. Erdogan was often applauded as a reformer who curbed the powers of the military and increased the standard of living for millions. One of his landmark reforms was to lift a decades-old ban on Islamist headscarves in the universities and the civil service. First-time voter Gizem is grateful.
If we have teachers, doctors, engineers wearing headscarves in this country today, that is all thanks to the freedoms Mr. Erdogan has granted. If it wasn't for him, we would still be oppressed in the name of secularism.
But some young people feel disenchanted by Mr. Erdogan. In 2021, students at Turkey's prestigious Boğaziçi University started protests against the appointment of a pro-government dean. 2 years on, the controversy continues. I met three students involved in the protests. Perit was imprisoned for 94 days, Emru has three lawsuits against him, and Sude has been detained twice.
How is it living in Turkey under this government as a young person?
I think it got worse and worse. I don't feel safe at all when I'm walking in the street, when I'm taking the bus. I'm scared of everyone.
You think this election might change everything for your future?
A very critical election, so it will change a lot of things.
Like what?
Like political Islam will be mostly gone and Turkey will be more secular for some period of time at least.
How female voters decide to cast their votes in the upcoming elections will also be crucial. They form more than half of the electorate. Mr. Erdogan's decision to pull Turkey out of a convention against domestic violence 2 years ago alienated many women and prompted large protests. Today, Turkey faces soaring inflation and is trying to recover from the recent earthquakes that killed over 50,000 people.
Selin Girit reporting from Turkey. A remarkable discovery has been made in a British museum. PhD student Megan Jacobs was doing some research when a colleague came across the fossilised bones of a gigantic sea creature called a pliosaur that lived 150 million years ago. The remains were found among lots of other old bones in a drawer in the museum in Oxfordshire. Megan told Sarah Montague more about the discovery.
I was looking at a big ichthyosaur, another type of marine reptile they have on display in the museum. They have sort of like drawers around the display with things for kids to look at. And my colleague Dave opened one of these drawers and there was a huge backbone in it. We were like, oh, is it dinosaur? It was dinner plate size. And they said, oh, we can get it out for you if you want to have a look. And we think we've got more in the museum stores as well. So we got out and had a look, concluded it wasn't dinosaur and it's a giant marine reptile.
Okay, when you say dinner plate size, are you talking about one vertebra, the size?
Yes.
Right.
Size of a dinner plate, yeah.
So these things were in the drawer, but the museum hadn't identified them or thought they might be representative of something so serious?
No, they had marine reptile or pliosaur vertebra on the label, but they had no idea that these were just ginormous for that type of animal. It's great.
Right, and it's great because as a result of this, you are, I was about to say we, but obviously, you are able to say this is how long this creature would have been.
Yeah.
Which is what? So how long?
We've got about a maximum estimate of just under 15 metres.
Right.
Which is huge.
That is a huge, great big thing.
That would have a skull 4 to 5 metres long.
And these are pretty scary things.
Yes. Mouthful of enormous banana-sized teeth. They definitely would have been the apex predator in the sea at the time. You wouldn't have wanted to go swimming in the late Jurassic seas, put it that way. Everything was eating everything else. And this thing was definitely right at the very top, eating everything else underneath it.
Megan Jacobs talking to Sarah Montague. Still to come on the Global News podcast.
As I was always love my sport, and that strips away any temptations of going out. But then I found drinking drugs. Then I lost myself for 6-7 years.
One of the greatest snooker players of all time opens up about his remarkable life. For the past few days, Pakistan has been convulsed by protests following the arrest of the ex-Prime Minister Imran Khan. The former cricket star was hauled out of a court appearance on Tuesday and detained by anti-corruption agents. Around 10 people died in the demonstrations that followed and some 2,000 were detained. In a rare show of anger towards the military, his supporters even attacked a number of army locations. On Thursday, the Supreme Court of Pakistan ruled that the arrest of Mr. Khan was illegal, prompting celebrations from his supporters.
Imran Khan's release proves we knew the truth. If they hadn't released Imran Khan, we would have spilled the last drop of our blood for him. We've been standing firm here for the last 2 days, and we will be standing firm in the future.
Mr. Khan is still facing more than 100 corruption charges, which his supporters say are an attempt to prevent him running in elections later this year. Despite ordering his immediate release, the Supreme Court said that for security reasons, he should remain in a police guest house until a new court appearance on Friday. With more on the day's events, here's our Pakistan correspondent Caroline Davis.
Mr. Khan appeared in front of the panel of three judges where he was told that the arrest that had happened on Tuesday was invalid and unlawful. Now, that is to do with the fact that they say that the way in which he was arrested, the fact that he was already inside the court complex at the time, that he was already going through the process of trying to submit himself to the justice system. He was in the process of getting his biometric data tested when the paratroopers came in, smashing glass, to arrest him. They said that he had the right to access justice that had been denied to him, and therefore this arrest was invalid and unlawful. The whole process instead means that he has to start it all over again with this particular corruption case that he is meant to be appearing in, and instead he's going to have to appear again in front of the Islamabad High Court on Friday.
It's a partial victory at least for Imran Khan in his battle with the military and the current government, but where does it go from here?
That is, of course, the next big question. This is some relief for Imran Khan, but is potentially just temporary relief, depending on exactly what happens in court. Now, this morning, we were, of course, thinking that Imran Khan was going to be within police custody for a further week, that a large number of his senior members of his party, the PTI party, had also been arrested. And despite the fact that there had been 2 days of protest following his arrest, it was uncertain about exactly whether these protests were going to be continuing and who was going to be giving any form of direction of what happens to the PTI movement after this. Now, of course, this appearance by Imran Khan, the fact that the arrest has been made invalid and unlawful, will, of course, probably give his supporters some hope and some energy. But exactly where that goes to next is really uncertain. This is still very much a power struggle that is happening between Imran Khan and what is referred to as the establishment here, which is the shorthand for the military and intelligence services. Imran Khan still very vehemently pushing to have what he is determining as free and fair elections as soon as possible.
Caroline Davis in Pakistan. The warring parties in Sudan have signed a deal to alleviate the suffering of civilians. The agreement followed 5 days of talks between delegates from the Sudanese armed forces and their rivals, the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces, in the Saudi city of Jeddah. It includes specific commitments to allow civilians to flee the conflict zone and guarantees the safety of humanitarian workers. The two sides have been unable to reach a full peace deal, but US representatives at the talks said they hope the signing of this agreement could create momentum. Our diplomatic correspondent Paul Adams reports.
The agreement reached in Jeddah is all about protecting civilians, not resolving political differences. Witnessed by American and Saudi officials, representatives of the two rival armies promised to protect civilians, including allowing safe passage for anyone wanting to get out of harm's way. A long list of pledges included respecting ambulances, not using civilians as human shields, and allowing the Red Cross to collect the dead. For relief agencies desperate to get aid to where it's needed, there are promises to allow rapid and unimpeded passage of humanitarian supplies. This is not yet a ceasefire agreement, despite a reference to what are described as regular humanitarian pauses. But the two sides have agreed to hold discussions aimed at a short-term ceasefire and to hold subsequent talks on a permanent cessation of hostilities. It's too early to know if anything agreed in Jeddah will actually stick.
Paul Adams reporting. The Bank of England has become the latest central bank to raise interest rates in the battle against inflation. UK prices are currently increasing at 10% year on year, but food price inflation is about double that. It's a similar story across much of the world, prompting accusations that food retailers are profiting unfairly. Rebecca Marston told me why food is so expensive at the moment.
Well, Ollie, we started from a weak position as we were just recovering from the effects of COVID on world trade and production. And then, of course, we had the war in Ukraine, which struck out produce from there. That, of course, is one of the world's most important suppliers of essentials, such as wheat and sunflower oil. This is the main reason that food prices spiked a year ago, that shortage of supply. Plus, that war also took out one of the world's biggest oil suppliers, Russia, and that hit energy prices, affecting the cost of production, storage, distribution of goods around the world and within countries, and that affected the cost of fertiliser, which accounts for a chunky 6 to 12% of many input costs. The oil price has, of course, been falling for some months, though, although producers and us consumers have only just begun to feel the effects of that.
Now, we've all been noticing our supermarket shops costing more. Is there evidence that food retailers are overcharging?
Well, some believe so. The leader of the British Liberal Democrat Party, Ed Davey, he's called for an inquiry into this to see if supermarkets are price gouging. And in the Republic of Ireland, there are calls to actually enforce lower food prices at the shops. But it's hard to find any evidence of this. And analysts, independent analysts, say profit margins at retailers are wafer thin amid competition. And Tesco, a leading UK supermarket, said it's not them overcharging, but it's producers upping prices, and the producers actually reject this.
Now, I've seen some prices coming down a little bit. What is the outlook?
Globally, the United Nations' latest food price inflation report shows prices of most main food groups falling. Dairy, cereal and vegetable oil, but meat prices are still rising, partly because of bird flu, and sugar, that's dramatically higher in price, up 17% between the months of March and April alone. So perhaps we'll have to lay off the sweets and cakes for a while.
Rebecca Marsden. In 1993, aged just 17, Ronnie the Rocket O'Sullivan won his first title at the UK Snooker Championship. Over the next 30 years, he became arguably the greatest player ever to hold a cue, winning 7 World Snooker Championships. It's an astonishing achievement for a man who came from very humble beginnings and whose parents ended up in prison. In a new memoir called Unbreakable, Ronnie reveals how he also had to deal with his own demons. he's been talking to Amal Rajan.
For me, snooker is, that's where I just feel relaxed and I feel calm. And if I go down to snooker club, I don't look at my phone for 3-4 hours. So for me, it's just a great escapism, you know, because I don't want to be on the phone all day. I don't want to be have to respond to emails or this and that. You know, I just want to keep my life as simple as I can, really.
I mean, you had a very, very remarkable childhood, and perhaps, and you go into it in the book, and perhaps the great shaping event was your dad's imprisonment. But before we get to that, was it a happy childhood despite all the chaos?
Yeah, very happy childhood. You know, what I remember of it, mum and dad both supporting, loving, doing the best that they can. And I hate kind of saying that I've ever had it hard, because there's so many more people out there that have had it so much harder than me.
Well, you're very humble about that. But, I mean, not many people go through what you went through when you're 16. Mm. So take us back to that moment. I think you were in Thailand when you found out that you're... dad had killed a man after an argument over a bill at a Chelsea nightclub.
Mm.
What happened?
My dad came from nothing, kind of got some money, maybe felt like the way to live that life was to go clubs, partying. Not that he ever drank, because he never, but I just felt like he had to fulfil this image of what success was. You know?
It's about class though, isn't it? Because he started with nothing.
Yeah.
And then having a lot affected him in a big way.
Just didn't manage it well, really. You know, like a lot of people, when they're born into it, it's like instilled in them to sort of, they call it new money, old money, I suppose. Old money know how to sort of like not let it get to the head. New money, they start behaving quite weird, you know, and doing things that you think, maybe that's not quite appropriate, I suppose.
So how have you managed it? You didn't grow up with much money and you've got a bit now.
I think what helped me was I was always loved my sport, you know, and that was always the thing that was so important to me. So I was kind of always like, as long as that's the most important thing and strips away any temptations of going out, and the more simple I keep my life, the better the snooker player I'm going to be. But then I found drinking drugs. Then I lost myself for 6-7 years, and then I kind of had to put myself back together. And I think going to rehab taught me that happiness is an inside job, which I truly believe. So since that moment, which was 2000, I've always believed that, you know.
When you reach your lowest low, how low was that?
I had a few. I mean, I've had a few clean as well. The obvious ones were putting a lot of weight, dependent on drinking and wacky backy just to kind of get through the day. You know, I lost my personality, I lost my confidence, felt like I needed to take substances just to socialise, you know. And then you get clean and then you kind of like, you become a little bit awkward in social situations. You think, well, how do I deal with these situations? Anxiety started to affect me in certain ways. So it was like, no, how do I live clean? And it was weird. It was like I had to learn how to do all that stuff again. And it took time. But once I got there, I realised that, you know, you have to carve out a different life for yourself. You know, my happy place is going running in the morning and I've got my running friends and I'm cool with that. Put me in an environment where there's a lot of people. I run for the corner.
Listen, you're 47. You're a dad. I think you're a granddad.
Mm.
Are you happy?
Yeah, I'm happy most of the time. You know, I don't take it for granted either because I'm one of them that I just get on with the day. I just put one foot in front of the other and I keep doing it. Last week, I had a film crew following me to do a documentary. I thought it was at this time in my life where, you know, it's the right time for them to sort of do that.
Yeah.
I watched it back, very uncomfortable watching myself. So there are things that in my life that trigger me and put me in a bad place. But I know that, and I then need to self-care afterwards.
Ronnie O'Sullivan talking to Amal Rajan. A book with no title and no known author has become a bestseller in the United States, even before its release. Many fans of the singer Taylor Swift are convinced that the work is in fact her memoir, prompting big pre-orders. Chantal Hartle has been looking at the theories.
Dear reader, if it feels like a trap, you're already in one.
This, the final song on Taylor Swift's latest album, is one of many apparent hints her fans have seized on. The $45 book, known only by its less-than-catchy title, 4C Untitled Flatiron Nonfiction Summer 2023, is due to be released on the 9th of July, a date which the singer has referenced in another of her songs. It's currently the number one pre-ordered book for some American publishers and is already out of stock on Amazon. Fans who call themselves Swifties are also speculating that the book's 544 pages add up to Swift's lucky number 13, which often features in her work. But others, like Kelsey Barnes, are holding out a bit longer until the true author is revealed next month.
there are some bookstores that are just using her lyrics just to promote the book, just to kind of drive up these pre-sales. July 9th is a lyric in one of her songs, so the timing makes sense. But she does like to give people the opportunity to pre-order and like get excited about it and to do press. So I am a little skeptical. I really hope it's true.
A few media sites say they have confirmed Taylor Swift is not the mystery author, but haven't given any alternative names. One New York bookshop said it would be cancelling more than 600 pre-orders for the book after receiving information that it is not linked to the singer. Another store in Wisconsin is offering full refunds if it turns out not to be Swift's memoir.
Chantal Hartle. And that's all from us for now, but the Global News podcast will be back very soon. This edition was mixed by Derek Clark and produced by Emma Joseph. Our editor's Karen Martin. I'm Oliver Conway. Until next time, goodbye.
Just imagine if you could quiet the noise and journey to deep sleep. Relax, I got you. I'm Shamir Anderson. Escape with me to soothing soundscapes around the globe. We'll wait out a storm on the Ethiopian highlands and take in the waves on a secluded Brazilian beach. Sleep sound with me, Shamir Anderson, an Audible original. Available now on audible.ca.
With DoorDash, you can now get even more delivered to your door. Groceries, self-care, restaurants, and snacks. With $0 delivery fees on your first order. Get more from your neighborhood delivered with DoorDash. Terms apply. Visit DoorDash.com.